Okay, let's turn please to Daniel 8. Daniel chapter 8. And let's begin reading from verse 1. Daniel chapter 8 is dealing with the next vision that Daniel is going to receive concerning God's dealing with the people of Israel. So let me read those verses. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw that I was in Shushan the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw a vision, and I was by the river of Ulai. Then I lifted up mine eyes, and I saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. And I saw a man pushing, I saw a ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will, and became great. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat, or a male goat, came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in a fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with rage against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore, he, the he-goat, waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones towards the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn, which waxed exceeding great, towards the south, towards the east, and towards the pleasant land. And it grew, or waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking to another saint, said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto him, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Just read with me verse 28 of chapter 7 for a minute, the prior chapter. In chapter 7 we read, hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts much trouble me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Let me just make a few points as we're going to start to speak about chapter 8 of the book of Daniel. First of all, remember that by the time we have finished chapter 7, At the end of chapter 7, we read about Daniel that his thoughts troubled him, and that his countenance had changed, and he kept the matter in his heart after he heard the interpretation of chapter 7. Daniel was so overwhelmed with what God had told him in chapter 7 about the four kingdoms that are going to proceed one after the other. So by the time he's getting to chapter 8 right now, his thoughts, as we read here, troubled him, his countenance changed, and he kept it in his heart. And later on, after chapter 7, a couple of years later, now he's really asking God. He says, God, now that you have told me, chapter 7, what is going to happen to the people of Israel and the kingdoms that will proceed one after another, God, I want to know what is going to happen to my people, the people of Israel. And so from chapter 8 now, to the end of the book of Daniel, to chapter 12, God is now speaking to Daniel, and he's going to tell him events which was directly connected with his own people, the Jewish people. First of all, I want you to understand, as we read chapter 8, verse 1, notice it says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. In the third year of the reign of the King Belshazzar. King Belshazzar was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. King Belshazzar was really the king of Babylon. But if you just go back to chapter 7 and verse 1, it says there, in the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. What we find out, that between chapter 7 to chapter 8, there are 2 years passed. In chapter 7, it was the first year of the reign of King Belshazzar. In chapter 8, it's the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. So, 2 years have passed between chapter 7 and chapter 8. If you remember also, that the chapter 2, verse 4, to the end of chapter 7, The writings have been written. Daniel wrote whatever he wrote in the language of the Chaldeans, in the Assyrian language, or the Aramaic, or Aramite. By the time we get to chapter 8 and verse 1, we are back to the Hebrew language. Chapter 8 and verse 1, now Daniel received information from God, directly that which has to do with the people of Israel, with the Jewish people. And so the language has changed from Aramaic to Hebrew. And now he's really receiving information concerning the nation of Israel, the Jewish people. Now the chapter is divided into really 3 points, or 3 major sections, or 3 sections I should say. First of all, chapter 8, verses 1 to 14 is the vision. Daniel received a vision, verses 1 to 14. Then verses 15 to 26 is the interpretation of the vision. Verses 15 to 26. And finally, in verse 27, is the conclusion. Verses 1 to 14 is the vision. Verses 15 to 26 is the interpretation of the vision. And verse 27 is the conclusion. The result that happened from Daniel receiving the information about that vision. Now, first of all, verses 1 to 14, look at the background. Verses 1 and 2 is the background. The background. Where did Daniel receive that vision? Notice it says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, this is 551 BC. It had been said that Daniel, by that time, he was about 70 years of age. In the year of 551 BC, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. In other words, he says, at the time when Belshazzar was in the third year of his reign, I received the vision, me, I, Daniel, just like I received the vision earlier at the first. Where did he receive the vision at the first? If you remember chapter 7 and verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions. So it is in a sense his second vision that he received. Remember, Daniel chapter 2, the vision was not given to him, it was given to Nebuchadnezzar. But in chapter 7, a vision was given unto him. Chapter 8 is the second vision that had been given unto Daniel, just the same like the one before, except with a different emphasis here in chapter 8. And so it says, it's 551 BC. Belshazzar was still the king. We have already covered, by the way, chapter 5 and chapter 6, but chapter 5 and chapter 6, in a chronological order, coming after chapter 8. But we have already covered them. And so in verse 1 and verse 2, we see the background. It was the second vision of Daniel, and it says here in verse 2, "And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Ulai." Now, remember, it is a vision. He was carried out, if you will, by a vision. He was carried out, if you will, to a different timing. He was physically still in Babylon. But he was carried in the vision to see something that is going to happen a little bit later on. And guess where it was? It says here, I saw in that vision, what does he saw? He saw that I was at Shushan in the palace. Shushan became the capital city of the Medes and the Persians. And Shushan, the palace, is the place where the king of Persia had been. So Daniel being taken up, if you will, by a vision to a further time, a little bit later on, after Israel, if you will be restored back, the Jewish people will go into the land of Israel to restore the temple and to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. He was taken up by a vision and he was placed in spirit in the place called Shushan the Palace, which is really the capital city of the Medes and the Persians. And it says there that it was in the province of Elam, and it says there that he saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Ulai. You know, the river of Ulai, from my understanding, from listening a little bit about the city of Shushan, the city of Shushan was situated in a corner area which had on the two sides of it, there were kind of two rivers. And in order to protect that city, they have built a connecting river. There was connecting, so the city itself would be surrounded, it was like a triangle, they would be surrounded by water for protection. And so what he sees himself by the river, which is called Ulai. That's the river that connected the two other rivers, the canal that connected the two rivers. And so it was like in a triangle, and so here he sees himself further on in the city called Shushan, he sees himself in a palace, and he was by a river that had been, by a canal that connecting the two rivers that surrounded the city of Shushan. This is verses 1 and 2, the background. Now what does he see in the vision? Notice that what he sees. In verse 3 and 4, he sees a ram. It says in verse 3, "Then I lifted up mine eyes, and I saw, and behold, there stood before me," or before the river, this is again the river which you call it Ulai, the river of Ulai, "he saw a ram which had two horns." A ram which had two horns. "And the two horns were high. The one was higher than the other. And then he says, and the higher came up last. And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will, and he became very great. So what does he see in a vision? He sees, first of all, a ram. Now you notice how interesting that this ram, it says about this ram, first of all, it says about this ram that he had two horns. Then in addition to that, he says that both of these horns were high. And then thirdly, we see in verse 3 that one of these horns was higher than the other. You know how beautiful the Bible is? It is, verse 3 is corresponding to chapter 2, where we have the image of this. You remember we had the Babylonians had the head of gold, and then it was the Medes and the Persian with the breast and the two hands. This ram corresponds with the chest, the breast and the hands of chapter 2, but it is also corresponds with chapter 7. If you remember just chapter 7 where we read about the four beasts, it corresponds with the bear of chapter 7. The bear in chapter 7 represented the Medes and the Persians. You remember the bear, four legs, but he was leaning a little bit on one side. One side was higher than the other. That was the Medes and the Persians. Both of them were great countries. They were united countries, but the Persian had superiority over the Medes. And so what we find here, that this particular ram represented the Medes and the Persian, the partnership kingdom. Now you might ask me, Gideon, how do you know that it represents the Medes and the Persian? Well, just turn your page to chapter, same chapter 8 and verse 20, and look how this very chapter gives us the interpretation. Let me read verse 20. Notice the interpretation. The ram which you saw, having two horns, are the kings of the Medes and the Persians. Very clearly. Chapter 8 verse 20 gives us the interpretation of chapter 8 verse 3 and 4. The ram represented the Medes and the Persians. Both of them, the two nations were great nations. They were the partnership nations. And then what happened? They had two horns. Both had, it was two high horns, but one of them was longer and higher than the other. And that is exactly what we find out in chapter 2 with the image, the chest and the arms represented the Medes and the Persian, and in chapter 7, the bear, which is standing lopsided, one side higher than the other, represented again the Medes and the Persian, but the Persian had a superior position than the Medes. And so we find out in verse 4, I saw the ram. Look what happened with the ram. He was pushing westward. He was pushing northward. He was pushing southwards. Why not eastward? Because that's where he came from. The Medes and the Persians. And so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will, and he became great. Well, that's what happened with the Medes and the Persians. They became a great nation. And they pushed. You see, no one could withhold to withstand against the Medo-Persians. And when they took, if you will, they became kingdom, they took over the Babylonians, and they became the next nation that had become the next kingdom that took over the position in this world. Well, that is the ram. The ram in verses 3 and 4, together with verse 20 of chapter 8, represent very clearly the Media and Persia. Then we continue in this chapter, and in verses 5 to 14, we have the next beast, if you will, called the he-goat, or the male goat. Verses 5 to the rest of the dream, the rest of the vision, up to verse 14. But let's break it down. First of all, in verse 5, we see the appearance of this particular he-goat. Verse 5 says, "And as I was considering," he was just considering now the ram, "behold," he says in verse 5, "a male goat, a he-goat, came from the west on the face of the whole earth. And he touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes." Now again, remember, the ram represent the Medes and the Persians. But now when we are talking about the goat, whom does the goat will represent? First of all, notice how it is interesting in verse 5, the appearance, it says here that he came from the west and on the face of the whole earth, but notice it says that he touched not the ground. This animal would have such a speed that as he was appearing in such a speed, such a fast way, that he did not even, it appears like he was not touching the ground. Well, it says here that it had a notable horn between his eyes. Now again, beloved brothers and sisters, this particular he-goat here represents the next nation that came after the Medes and the Persians, and that is the Grecians, the nation of Greece. It is interesting that as you have here this he-goat represented in verse 5, with the speed that he was coming over, and it says that on the face of the whole earth, in other words, he was conquering the whole earth, and that's represent the he-goat here with the notable horn which is between his eyes, represent to us none else but the Grecians with Alexander the Great, the first king of the Greeks, of the Greek people. You notice, by the way, you asked me again, and it's a good question to ask, how do we know that the he-goat of verse 5 is the Grecian? Well, just turn your page to verse 21 and 22, and you notice what chapter 8, the interpretation gives us. In verse 21, and I'm just going to read verse 21 for now, "And the rough goat is the king of Greece." If the ram is Middle Persian, the goat is the king of Greece. Now, let me again remind you. You remember in the image of chapter 2, in the vision that King Nebuchadnezzar has seen, what did he see? The great image, gold, Babylon. Silver, Medo-Persia, the chest and the hand. And then the thighs and the legs represented the kingdom of Grecia. And the Greek represented by United Nations, which have been divided later on. It is interesting to see how that here we see that this goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Notable horn between his eyes. What about chapter 7? In chapter 7, when we have been speaking about the four beasts that Daniel has seen, well, the lion represented Babylon, the bear who was lopsided represented the Medes and the Persians, but the leopard is corresponding with chapter 8 and verse 5. The he-goat correspond with the leopard of chapter 7. And you remember when we read about the leopard, it says that, "I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon his back four wings of fowl, and the beast had also four heads, and dominion was given unto it." In other words, there was a speed with the four wings, the speed in which Alexander the Great had conquered nation after nation, and eventually took over the Medes and the Persians. And so, in verse 5, we see the appearance of the Greek people with their king, the notable horn, which representing Alexander the Great. He swiftly conquered nation after nation. In verse 5 it says that he came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and he touched not the ground. Now verse 6 and 7 then, if verse 5 shows us his appearance, verse 6 and 7, notice what this goat does. He destroy the ram, the Medo-Persian. In verse 6 we read, and he came, this is the goat, came to the ram that had the two horns, which had seen standing before the river. And he ran unto him in the fury of his power, and I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with rage against him, and he smote the ram, and he brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. And so the he-goat represented, of course, the Greek with the king Alexander the Great. Notice the step by step in verse 7. He came close to the ram. He moved with rage against the ram. He smote the ram. He broke the two horns. That has to do with the Mede and the Persian. And then he cast him down to the ground, and none could deliver the ram out of his hand. Verses 21 and 22 tells us exactly what we just read in those early verses. Verse 21, it says, and the rough goat is the king of Grisha, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. That is Alexander the Great. And so we find out that in this vision, we get number one, Daniel was taken all the way from the time that he was in bodily in Babylon. He was taken all the way, if you will, in spirit, to see himself now in Shushan the palace, the Medes and the Persian. And then even beyond them, he sees himself in a time where Alexander, the king of Greece, came and smote and totally destroyed the Medes and the Persian in verses 6 and 7. Now notice what happened. In verse 8 is the third division of this part. In verse 8 we see the divisions of the four horns. In verse 8, Alexander died, and other generals took the kingdom. It took quite a while before it settled. There was a lot of wars in between. It took, some said, about 20 years before the generals really, there was rest in a sense, that the kingdom had been divided. But notice it says in verse 8, therefore the he-goat waxed very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones towards the four winds of heaven. In verse 8 we have four generals ruled Alexander's empire after his death by 301 BC. When Alexander died, I understand that he died drunk, young man, about 32 years old or so, and his four generals took over the kingdom. Again, I want you to turn to verse 22 for a minute, please. Verse 22, to see the interpretation immediately. In verse 22 we read, now that being broken, this is that first king, he was broken, four stood up for it. Four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. So you see what interesting it is here in this, what is so interesting here is that the Medes and the Persians took over the Babylonian. The Grecians under Alexander took over the Medes and the Persians. Alexander was so swift, so fast, but he got drunk. He died very early. And then four of his generals have taken the kingdom. And we read here in verse 8 that he was broken. Why? because when he was very great, you know what pride and greatness brings? A fall if there is no humility and acknowledge that it all came from God. Remember that we read it in Scripture. God resists the proud, but giveth grace to the humble. Pride comes before a fall, we read it in the Scripture. And so when he waxed great, it says in verse 8, very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken. Alexander died. And what happened? Four notable ones came up after. And those, by the way, four notable ones are four horns, which represented the four generals that came after the death of Alexander. And so, verse 5, the appearance. Verse 6 and 7, the destruction of the ram by the he-goat. Verse 8, the death of this Alexander, which is that particular notable horn that was between the eyes of the he-goat. When he had been destroyed, four notable horns came out. Those four horns represent four kings and four kingdoms, which will rule the kingdom of the Grecians. By the way, the names of those four generals are Ptolemy, he took Egypt, and I mark it for myself. Seleucus, he took Syria. Lysimachus, he took another area, and then we have Cassander. Cassander, he took Macedonia and Greece. Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Cassander, the four generals that took over the kingdom after the death of Alexander the Great. Okay, now verses 9 to 14, we have an additional information now. Notice that we are still speaking about the Grecian Empire. We don't go beyond that in this chapter. It is interesting that while chapter 7 took us to from Babylon to Medo-Persia, from Medo-Persia to Greece, and from Greece to the Roman Empire, chapter 8 does not go beyond here, beyond the Grecian Empire when it's come to the first 14 verses. It takes us all the way up till the Grecian Empire. You notice that after we read the interpretation in verse 20, the ram was Medo-Persia, and in verse 21 it was the king of Grecia. We don't have any beyond the king of Grecia in this chapter, except the four generals, and out of those four generals, it's still the empire of Greece. And so now verse 9 to 14, we have an additional little horn. Now verses 9 to 14, we have an additional little horn. We'll divide it into two sections. First of all, verses 9 to 12, we see the activities of another little horn that is rising up. Verse 9 says, and out of one of them, which one? One of the four kingdoms that have took over the kingdom of Greece after the death of Alexander. One out of one of those kingdoms came forth a little horn. In other words, out of one of them came a little horn, and this little horn, we read in verse 9, waxed exceedingly great. And so, if you just imagine, out of one of these four kingdoms came another little horn who became another king that was a descendant of one of those four general kings. And so it says here in verse 9, first of all, notice this one, how his activities of this little horn. It says here, he waxed great towards the south, that's towards Egypt, towards the east, this is towards Mesopotamia, and then towards the pleasant land. The pleasant land in verse 9 is the glorious land. It is the land of Israel. In other words, that little horn, that little king, or that king that became very powerful, he came out of one of those four kingdoms which came out of the one kingdom, which was Alexander the Great, the Grecian kingdom. And so he came, and it's very much this particular person, this little horn in verse 9, is none other but Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth, the one who became the king of Assyria, or Syria, the Grecian Syrian king. His name was Antiochus. He called himself Antiochus Epiphanes, which is really saying that he called himself a person who is God manifest. Antiochus Epiphanes, he wanted to exalt himself. He wanted to, he considered himself God manifest. And so as we read here in verse 9, Antiochus reigned from 175 BC to 163 BC. Antiochus was a wicked man who hated the people of Israel, the Jewish people. He hated so much the Jewish people that he persecuted the Jewish people in such a way that Israel became a battleground. You notice it says here in verse 9, he waxed exceedingly great towards the south. Apparently he had constant fight against Egypt. Syria, king of the north. Egypt, king of the south, and they had constant fight between the king of the north and the king of the south, and in between was the land of Israel. And then we read, so he waxed towards the south, Egypt, towards the east, Mesopotamia, and notice he waxed very great towards the glorious land, it says here in verse 9. So he is the kingdom of Assyria, the king of Assyria, which rose and became very powerful. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes, and he is the wicked king that oppressed the Jewish people. Now, just for a minute, I want you to go to the prophet Jeremiah in chapter 3. Jeremiah chapter 3. In Jeremiah chapter 3 we read in verse 19, we are speaking about, we want to know where is that pleasant land or glorious land as we read in verse 9. It says in Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 19, but I said, how shall I put thee among the children and give thee a pleasant land, a goodly heritage of the hosts of nations. And I said, thou shalt call me my father, and shall not turn away from me. And give thee a pleasant land. The pleasant land has a reference to the land of Israel. Also, please go to Ezekiel chapter 20 and verse 6. Ezekiel chapter 20 and verse 6. Ezekiel chapter 20 verse 6, and I'm reading verse 6. In the day that I lifted up mine hand unto them, to bring them forth of the land of Egypt, into a land that I had espies for them, flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands. Again, when God brought Israel out of Egypt, God had brought Israel into this glorious land. He calls it the glory of all lands when he brought Israel outside of the land of Egypt. One more verse. Zechariah chapter 7. Zechariah chapter 7 and verse 14. The last verse. But I scatter them with a whirlwind among all the nations, whom they knew not. Thus the land was desolate after them, that no man pass through nor return, for they laid the pleasant land desolate. And so, beloved, when we are talking about the pleasant land in the scriptures, it has a reference here in chapter 8 to none else but the Holy Land, the land of the Bible, the land, the promised land, the land that God had promised to give to the nation of Israel. Of course, when we call it holy, we only mean that it's holy when God has his authority in the land. Unfortunately, it became unholy when Israel disobeyed God, when the nations have done what they have done to the land, it became unholy. But it is that pleasant land, the land that is flowing with flow, with milk and honey. And so, in verse 9, we see the rise to power by this Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, let me just remind you for a second before I'm going to go to verse 10. We are now exactly celebrating the Jewish holiday, which is called Hanukkah, the feast of dedication. Now, you may ask yourself, how did we arrive to celebrate the feast of Hanukkah? You know, one thing for sure we know, that we do not know when Jesus was born into this world. The exact date we do not know, and I can assure you it was not on the 25th of December. But one thing we do know, that the Lord Jesus, when he came to this world, he was walking in a temple in Jerusalem. He was walking in a temple that once needed to be cleansed and dedicated. In the year of 165 BC, the temple in Jerusalem had been cleansed and dedicated by a man by the name of Judah, Yehuda HaMaccabee. Yehuda the Hammer and his family. You know, this man by the name Antiochus Epiphanes, that we read about him in chapter 8 and verse 9. That wicked man waxed great, exceeding great, and he went towards Egypt, and he went all the way towards the east, and he went all the way to the promised land, to the pleasant land. And what do you think he have done there? Antiochus Epiphanes have done such a wicked thing. He have killed so many Jewish people. It was unbelievable. If you read the story of Hanukkah, or the Feast of Dedication, it is amazing how that feast came about. This man Antiochus, this man that was so great, went into Israel, into the pleasant land, and he forbade our Jewish people, our own people, he forbade them to be circumcised. He forbade them to keep the Shabbat. He forbade them to keep the holidays. He forbade them to keep the religious order and the sacrificial system to go ahead. He stopped this because he wanted to be worshipped and to take the place of God in the temple in Jerusalem. As you go on now, please turn to verse 10 in Daniel chapter 8. Let's just see what happened. Let's see what happened. When we are speaking about the Feast of Dedication in the present day, we have to realize that it came from somewhere. There is a history behind it. And the history behind it has to do with chapter 8 of Daniel, and verses, especially verses 9 to verse 14. Notice now verse 10. We read verse 9, and we see the rise to power of this wicked man in the kingdom of Assyria by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth. He reigned from 175 BC to 163 BC. And notice what it says in verse 10. And it, of course, this is this horn which represented Antiochus, it waxed great. In other words, it grew, even to the host of heaven. In verse 10, we see his war against the Jewish people, my people, our people. He works against the host of heaven. The host of heaven really represent the high priest that were representing God in the temple in Jerusalem. He works against the against the host of heaven, and then it says that and it cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground, and he stamped upon them. Verse 10 really teaches us the war against the Jewish people that Assyrian king, Grecian king, Antiochus Epiphany have made. Notice, let me just show you some of the things here. They waxed a great even to the host of heaven. The word host of heaven has to do with the people of Israel, the Jewish people, who were here called the host of heaven. Now, how do I know that the word host of heaven here represent the Jewish people? Remember, it says in verse 9, he waxed exceedingly great towards the pleasant land. So he went to the pleasant land, and he waxed, grew great, even to the host of heaven. Now, if you underline the word the host of heaven, and I want you to look at two verses in the Old Testament with me. The first verse is found in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 5. In Genesis chapter 15 and verse 5, God makes a covenant with Abraham, the father of the nation of Israel. God made a covenant with Abraham, and notice what God says to Abraham in verse 5. And he brought him forth abroad, and he said, look now toward heaven and tell the stars if thou art able to number them. And he said unto him, so shall thy seed be. Abraham, look towards the stars. Can you number the stars? That's how many your descendants are going to be. Now, of course, I know that many times we take the stars of heaven to represent the heavenly company or the believers from among the Gentiles. And we look at the sand of the sea, because he told him, can you number the sand of the sea? We usually represent the Jewish people, the nation of Israel. But in Antiochus coming to the pleasant land and going against the host of heaven, this in the pleasant land, when it's coming to the time that Antiochus reigned, has a reference to the Jewish people, to the people of Israel. Now look with me to another interesting verse in Exodus chapter 12 now. Again, we are looking at what is the host of heaven represent, that this wicked king, which have been waxing great, what it represents. Again, notice, chapter 12 of Exodus, and this time, verse 40, chapter 12, and verse 41. Let me read verse 40 also. Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwell in Egypt was 430 years. In other words, Israel became slaves in Egypt for 430 years. Then verse 41. And it came to pass, at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day, it came to pass that all the host of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. The host, the armies of the Lord in Exodus 12 and verse 41 is none else but the children of Israel who came out of Egypt. To Abraham, chapter 15 of Genesis, verse 5, the host there, the stars, represented the seed, the descendants of Abraham. The hosts. And so what we really see, taking those two verses, Genesis 12 and verse 5, Genesis 15, 5, and Exodus 12 and verse 41, we put it together with verse 10, and it works great even to the host of heaven. Now, what does it mean? He didn't become great towards heaven. In other words, he works great and powerful against the Jewish people. And then it says in verse 10, and he cast down some of the host. In other words, he succeeded to trample and to cast down and to kill some of the Jewish people and of the stars to the ground, and he stamped upon them. Now that wicked king, the king of the north, the king of Syria, the Grecian Syrian king by the name of Antiochus, he have done damage, and he done so much evil to the Jewish people, it's unbelievable. It had been said, by the way, that he took babies and he killed them, and then he tied them again around the neck of their mothers. How wicked that man have been. He hated the Jewish people. Notice, by the way, now in verse 11, quickly. Notice we are talking about his rise to power in verse 9, his wars against the Jewish people in verse 10, and notice some of his action and some of his evil deeds that he did in verse 11 and verse 12. Notice in verse 11. Yea, he magnified himself even to the priest of the host. Now again, the prince is the high priest. The host is the Jewish people. So, and the he, that's horn, is Antiochus Epiphanes. He magnified, he lifted himself up above the high priest, which represented the Jewish people before God. Secondly, in verse 11, some of his activity, by him the daily sacrifice was taken away. You know what he did? He stopped the daily sacrifices to be offered in the temple in Jerusalem. Notice next what he had done. The place of his sanctuary was cast down. He desecrated the sanctuary, the temple. That was Antiochus the fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes. And you know the word Epiphany means the manifest God. He wanted that everyone will acknowledge him as God. And so in verse 11, we see three things. He magnified himself even to the prince of the host. By him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. Desecration of the sanctuary. Then notice in verse 12, an additional activities of this wicked, wicked man. In verse 12 we read, and a host was given him by him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgressions. Notice again, it says here a host, in other words, some of the Jewish people have been won over by him. And because, why? It says in verse 12, by reason of transgression, some of the Jewish people, because of their transgressions and sin, they violated the will of God, and they have followed him and allowed and agreed with him and was willing to do what he asked them to do. Let me just tell you quickly a story, and please bear with me.
The only way that we know about the feast of Hanukkah, the feast of dedication from the Bible, from the Old Testament now, is only prophetically given to us by Daniel. Daniel, again, remember, he was carried by the spirit, in spirit, to the time of the Grecians. Babylonian, he was in the time of Babylonian, he was carried all the way. He saw the ram, which is made of Persian, and he also saw the Grecians. He was not there, but he was in spirit. So prophetically he received information. Daniel, there is coming a day when the people of Israel, the Jewish people, are going to suffer tremendously by a certain man, by the name, we don't read the name, by the name of, we know it, Antiochus the Fourth. And this man is going to desecrate the temple. This man is going to cause all kind of havoc among the Jewish people. That's what is going to happen. Now let me tell you the story. The story had been told that Antiochus Epiphanes had gone to the temple in Jerusalem. And you know what he did? In the temple in Jerusalem, where the Jewish people offer sacrifices without blemish to the God of Israel, what did he do? He put an image of Zeus in the temple. And he took pig, and he offered a pig, on the female pig, on the altar. And then he went to a town, he sent some of his commanders to a town called a city called Modi'in. Modin or Modi'in in Hebrew. In that city lived a family, and a family with a man by the name of Mattathiah or Mattithiahu. Mattai, he had five sons. One of his sons was a man by the name of Yehuda, Judah. When some of his soldiers came to this city called Modin, they asked Mattithiahu to go and to offer a pig on an altar. Mattithiahu, who was a godly man, did not want to offer that sacrifice. So then the soldiers, the Grecian soldiers asked one of the other Jewish people to go and to offer a sacrifice on the altar. When this Jewish man was ready to go to offer a pig on the altar in Modi'in, Mattithiahu took a sword and killed that Jewish man. After killing that Jewish man, then the soldiers came to try to do something to Mattithiahu. This is history, Jewish history. Mattithiahu and his five sons fought against the Syrian Grecian army. And when they fought with them, they killed them, and they fled to the mountains. And as they were fleeing to the mountain, they had gathered a large, what we call, guerrilla Jewish army against the Assyrians. And they were constantly attacking the Assyrians. And as the Assyrian, which was really Grecian, under the influence of Greece at that time. This is again 168 BC. For 168 BC, for 3 years, it took 3 years from the time that the temple had been desecrated up to the time that the temple had been cleansed. And Mattithiahu, and of course his son Judah the Maccabee, they call themselves, by the way, they call themselves the Maccabim, or the hammers, because they were hammering against the Syrian Grecian army. And so that story, by the way, came about, the story of Hanukkah came about right here from the prophecy of Daniel, who was prophesying concerning this future event. Please bear with me for five more minutes and I'm going to close. in verse 12, notice what it said in verse 12. A horse was given him against a daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. In other words, some of the Jewish people did submit to him and followed after him. Not all, but some. And then it says in verse 12b, and it cast down the truth to the ground. In other words, when you think about casting down the truth to the ground, all that which represented the worship of God had been, if you will, desecrated in the temple. And then finally, at the end of verse 12, and it practiced and he prospered. In other words, Antiochus practiced what he wanted, this pagan religion, and he succeeded, he prospered. And so we read in verse 11 and 12 about his activities here in the the time when he was reigning. And then notice now quickly in verse 13 and 14, we hear all of a sudden in verse 13 and 14, we see the 2,300 evenings and mornings. And I'm reading, the length of time that Antiochus' activities against the Jewish people will be. In verse 13, and I heard, this is Daniel, he is hearing one of the saints, this is an angel, holy one, one holy one, this is an angel speaking. And another holy one said unto that certain holy one which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice? Remember, the daily sacrifice stopped. How long will it take for the daily sacrifice to be in that situation? And then read, they continue, and the transgression of desolation. How long shall the temple going to be desecrated? How long there will be the desolation, the transgression of desolation? To give both a sanctuary and the horse to be trodden underfoot. How long time will it happen, will be allowed this thing to happen? Well, verse 14. The answer is given us in verse 14. And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days. Then, notice at the end in verse 14, shall the sanctuary be cleansed. In other words, one angel was saying to another angel, proclaiming, how long will it take for this transgression of desolation, that the sanctuary will be trodden down underfoot? How long? And the answer came, 2,300 days. Then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now if you will take 2,300 days, this is mornings and evenings, and you will divide it into 30 day a month according to the lunar Jewish counting, you will find out that it is approximately 6 years and 4 months. And then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Now we know from history that on the 25th of the month of the Jewish month of Kislev, in 165 BC, the temple had been cleansed in the city of Jerusalem by Judah the Maccabees and his family and the rest of the nation of Israel by a tremendous victory against Antiochus Epiphanes and his army. Now, if you will take from the 25th day of the month of Kislev, 165 BC, and you take it back 6 years and 4 months, you will find out that this was about the time that Antiochus Epiphanes became the king and was the one that have done so much desecration and suffering caused upon the Jewish people and the people of Israel that have lived in the land of Israel. And you notice, by the way, that from 171 BC to 165 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes persecuted the Jewish people, which is about 6 years and 4 months. So the persecution of the Jewish people by Antiochus, and the desecration of the temple, and causing the sacrifice to cease and to stop, and all what he has done, the worshipping of Zeus and the offering of a pig on the altar, all this happened during those 6 years and 4 months and so on. Of course, the temple was the persecution began earlier, before the desecration of the temple, but in total, 2,300 days, 6 years and 4 months, that Antiochus will be able to persecute the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Now, in closing, I just want you please to listen to one more short story. It says, "Then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." In 165 BC, the Jewish people have cleansed the temple. In the 25th day of the month of Kislev, the Jewish people have cleansed the temple. And you know, there was a problem there, is because when they cleansed the temple, they wanted to, what did they want to do? To light the menorah, the candlestick, the lampstand. And they didn't have any oil. So there's a legend, a very interesting legend, that what happened, they had found a little pot of oil was just enough for one day to light the menorah, to light the candlestick, the lampstand. And they had to make a choice. If they would take this little oil that they found and light the menorah, that was only sufficient for one day. But it takes 7 days to prepare new oil because they didn't have any more oil. What should they do? Should they light the menorah right away? Or should they, on the 25th of Kislev, or should they wait another 8 days, 7 days, and light it again, and make oil, prepare it, because it was specifically prepared by a proper order, proper perfume, and so on. It had to be possible to make this, to light the candles, and the lampstand. And you know, the story, and again, it's a legend, is that that little pot of oil that had been found, they, on the 25th of the month of Kislev, they did lit the menorah, the lampstand. And in a miraculous way, the lampstand remained lit for 8 days. Just enough for them to prepare an additional 7 days to prepare oil so the menorah will continue to be lit. Because it was never supposed to be turned off. It was always, the lampstand always needed to remain lit. Always. And the story is that in a miraculous way, that lampstand remained lit for an additional 7 days. Let me just finish with this. Now, it is interesting because it was a miracle. It was a miracle. Now, The great miracle that we see here, that a small group of Jewish people could succeed to fight against such a great army as the Grecian-Syrian army of Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphany, and to succeed to defeat them. And it was not because of their strength. It is in a miraculous way that God had provided for them a way whereby he could maintain the Jewish people and maintain the temple. Now, why I'm saying it is so important? Because guess what? 2,000 years approximately after 165 BC, guess who walked in the very same temple that had been preserved by God in a supernatural way? In about 30 AD, you read in John 10 and verse 22, guess who walked in the temple? And I have to read it. I'm sorry that I'm doing it, but I have to read it. John 10 verse 22, and it was at Jerusalem, the feast of dedication. Again, here you get the word dedication. And it was winter, and it's exactly in this time, winter time. And Yeshua walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. What would have happened if the Jewish people would not be preserved in the year 165 BC? You know, if the temple had not been there preserved by God in a miraculous way, then we would not have Jesus the Messiah, the Lord Jesus, the Lord Yeshua the Messiah, walking in the temple in Jerusalem in the feast. And that's the only place in the Bible that you find the word the feast of dedication. It's found in John 10 and verse 22. Jesus, Yeshua, is walking in the same feast, in the same temple that had been preserved by God in a miraculous way. And then you know what he says in the temple? He offered himself to the people of Israel, and he offered to give them a greater miracle than merely lighting the candles or preserving the temple. But the greater miracle, he says, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they will follow me, and I'll give unto them everlasting life, and they shall never perish. No one is able to pluck them out of my hand. The greatest miracle that Hanukkah is really represent is the miracle of the gift of eternal life, which every one of us who have come to faith in the Messiah have, because we have acknowledged what the Lord Jesus have done for us. Can we say amen to that?
Amen.